Geneva College, Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania, Monday afternoon, November 6, 1972, Bible 302, the wisdom literature of the Old Testament, continuing the study of Ecclesiastes and picking it up today as syllabus question 474, Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verses 5 to 7. Now, you realize that we have a test coming up on Wednesday, Election Day plus one. I hope you will have recovered your emotional poise sufficiently by Wednesday to do this. And we should cover today up to 520 to be properly set for this test. And in order to do this, I will skip some of the more simple and obvious matters, unless questions are raised about them, and hit on some of the more difficult things. Now, chapter 7, verses 5 to 7, the value of the rebuke of the wise in times of suffering. Hearing the rebuke of a wise man does more for you than hearing the song of fools. To what does the 476 Kohelet compare the laughter of the fool? It's a little, sort of a nifty little line he gives there. What does anybody remember? Mrs. Hartman? Sound of the metal under the kettle? Yeah, he tries to reproduce in English a play on words in Hebrew. Now, any of you that come from the West know what tumbleweed is. It doesn't grow around here, but Kansas, Nebraska, and Oklahoma, tumbleweed. It's very big ears, 4 or 5 feet thick, and rolls along the road. Once in a while, one of these things catches fire. And when it does, it burns with a furious heat for about 2 or 3 minutes, and then it's falling through. It's just ashes. So a fierce fire of the thorns, it says in Ecclesiastes here, dry, you know, and easy to burn. It catches fire and burns furiously, but just for a little bit, and then it's all over, and there's nothing to it anymore. So the sound of the metal under the kettle, the laughter of the fool, it's a crack or a joke for the moment, but it has no permanent effect or value. Now, please note that humor is a gift of God intended for our good, and it can be used or misused. I consider Bob Hope's jokes dirty and suggestive, and they leave you feeling a bad taste in your mouth and that your ears have been dirtied a little bit. People get paid big money to clean up one of his programs. On the other hand, there is such a thing as wholesome and healthy humor. Now, let me tell you, John Calvin is considered history's number one unparalleled and greatest sourpuss. That's the image of John Calvin. Completely unsound. Luther was also considered a very morose person without any sense of humor. Both of these images undeserved. Calvin was a busy man and he was serious-minded, but not lacking in humor. He founded the Academy of Geneva, which is today the University of Geneva, and they had students from all over Europe, and like students everywhere, they played some practical jokes, and some of them at Calvin's expense. And one of his colleagues on the faculty said, John, don't take it off them, don't stand for any nonsense, crack down on them and show them you won't stand for any monkey business in this school. And Calvin said, no, they are young, and they have a right to some fun. Just remember that when somebody brings up the traditional image of John Calvin. They're young and they have a right to some fun. They refuse to crack down on them. And Martin Luther said, you might as well plant a pine tree in a flower pot and expect it to grow to something as to expect young people to live without joy. That was Martin Luther. So the reformers, while they were engaged in a, let's say, deadly serious conflict in their day, were not lacking in an appreciation of wholesome and healthy humor. And this is very different from the kind that smells of hell that we hear sometimes today. Now we'll leave that. People become fools by compromise with moral evil, and then one thing leads to another. And chapter 7, verse 7, the perpetrators of oppression that are mentioned there. Oppression maketh a wise man mad, and a gift destroyeth the heart. Oppression can get so bad that a thinking person nearly goes crazy on account of it. This was true in Budapest, Hungary, a few years ago when the Soviets betrayed them and destroyed their freedom, and people were almost driven to desperation in the things that they did. And I'm afraid that the Voice of America radio had made them promises that our country did not keep. Now, oppression, who are these officials that are so wicked and so oppressive? According to Leupold, who holds that the book was written in the Persian period, these would be some of the Persian officials. The value of patient endurance of suffering in chapter 7, 8 to 10. And he says that the end of something is more important than the beginning. Shakespeare said, all's well that ends well. If you can have patience to wait, the issues may resolve themselves and come to the only possible conclusion, and the person who can wait this out will weather the storm and be a survivor of it. A sinful tendency warned against in chapter 7, verse 9 is that of growing vexed in time of distress, becoming worrisome and fretful when you are faced with misfortune or trouble or suffering of some kind. One of my favorite psalms is Psalm 37. It's done a lot for me. Fret not thyself because of evildoers, and so forth. Fret not thyself, speak from anger and forsake wrath. Fret not thyself in any wise to do evil. And it speaks of the eternal outcomes of evildoers and of the true children and people of God. Now, Mr. McMillan, Reverend Willard McMillan, spoke at a conversation on apathy. He also had a piece in the cabinet on this a couple years ago, and said that it is mostly the non-Christian students in the college that are all upset about having so much apathy around here, and that the Christian student has so much of the higher values that he is not inclined to make an issue of every little thing, but to realize that these things will work out in due course, and of course some things need to be changed, we recognize that, but that the person who has to make an issue of everything is inwardly insecure and discontented, and if he had the real joy that comes from knowing Christ, he wouldn't feel like getting upset about everything there is. I read this statement in a published newspaper publication that time a couple of years ago when Nixon ordered a temporary invasion of Cambodia. Students in many schools rioted over this, and one the leader of the riot group was quoted as saying, we were planning to riot anyhow. If it hadn't have been Cambodia, it would have been something else. So that's the wrong kind of a state of mind. A student I had in night school, he was a girl that had a physical handicap and affliction too, but he said, Psalm 37 was to fret not thyself. You can say that in modern Beaver Valley English school. This phrase is slightly dated today, I guess. Truly, fret not thyself. So your attitude is to be Christian contentment and faith rather than, let's say, continually being discontented and sort of edgy about all sorts of things that possibly aren't of first importance anyhow. Now, why does the wise man not look back with longing to the good old days? We are not to say that the former days were better than these. We're told here in chapter 7, verse 10, it is not wise to phrase this question. Every age has its good and its bad features. It is typical of elderly people as they get older to think back on the good old days with a haze of nostalgic romanticism. And they forget what the so-called good old days were really like, and they idealize them to be much better than what they were. Confucius, the great sage of China, 500 BC, he was spite of being a great man, he had this nostalgic notion about the good old days. Yao and Xuan, the first two emperors of China, completely legendary, but in their day, everybody was civil and courteous and friendly and thoughtful and kind-hearted and generous, and the good old, neighborly and even Christmas spirit was simply all over the place. And what China needed, according to Confucius, was to get back to the good old days. Now, needless to say, there has never been a time in China when the general climate of everything was friendly and lovely and so forth. As far as any recorded history, China has been in a good bit of tough trouble and turmoil. But Confucius harks back to what he called the good old days. This we should not do. God has placed us in the present to live in the situation of the present. We need to know something about the past, of course, but we should not look with nostalgic or repining and think that if we could have lived back in the good old days, 200 years ago, maybe life would have been so much better. You could mail a letter for a penny and all, so forth. But really, God has placed us in the present, and we should live in the present and look toward the future, and not touch back toward the past in that way. And the value of wisdom as fine regulators in days of suffering. Now, chapter 7, verse 11, this requires a little attention because of a question about how it should be translated. The King James Version says, wisdom is good with an inheritance, and by it there's profit to them that see the sun. Leopold translates it, wisdom is as good as an inheritance, an advantage over it for them that to see the sun. That is, people living in this life, in this world, who are under the sun. Now, according to the King James translation of this verse, the idea is it's fine to have a lot of money, and then if you can have wisdom too, you've already got it made. Wisdom with an inheritance. Get the inheritance and then get the wisdom, and you got everything. But Leopold says this is almost certainly incorrect, that it is a comparison and not a combination here. Wisdom is as good as an inheritance and even has an advantage over it to people in this present life. Now, you have to realize the attitude of ancient Israel toward, real estate or property. They traded this. It was seldom sold. It was kept in the family from father to son. The book of Deuteronomy gives an elaborate law that was intended to prevent alienation of property from the family that held it, and to prevent it being assimilated by rich people in big estates. The law of the year of Jubilee also did this, that at the end of 50 years, the land goes back to the former owners. This place down here, we're getting ready to build a big parking lot or something, send back to the Armstrong Court lot after the end of the 7 times 7 years, if we did it under the Old Testament system. And this is illustrated by the book of Ruth. Boaz, and one of my invited students called Bozo, he said the second husband of Ruth is a man named Bozo. Boaz put up the money and redeemed the mortgage property of Ruth and Naomi's family and got it back into the proper family again. And this shows the answer. Ahab wanted the vineyard of Naboth because it was handed to his house. And Naboth wouldn't sell. Said, God forbid that I should sell the inheritance of my forefathers. He was within his right to force. And please note, to the credit of Ahab, he didn't try to get it by force. He tried to get it by bargaining, and when Naboth wouldn't sell, Ahab went back to his palace and lay down on his bed and turned his face to the wall and indulged in a fit of the royal sulk. And Jezebel, her nib, came in, and she got this for Ahab by committing a murder. He had Naboth railroaded. He was unjustly stoned to death. But you see, Naboth's unwillingness to sell that, in line with the whole teaching in the Old Testament about this kind of thing, illustrates this idea. An inheritance is something that you have permanently, and you hand it down to your children and grandchildren, and they are theirs. And it is supposed, and would be very seldom and under very unusual circumstances, that it could be sold. So wisdom is compared to this. It's something that will last, and it's of lasting importance and value, and even better, maybe, than an inheritance because of what it does for you. Now, he goes on and explains this.
Now, wisdom has an advantage over money because wisdom gives life to those that have it. This raises, of course, the question, what kind of wisdom are you talking about and what kind of life? There's one kind of wisdom. There's the true wisdom, and then there's all sorts of worldly wisdom that we wouldn't accept as the true wisdom. And then there are different kinds of life. Bacteria have life, and so do all sorts of bugs. And we humans have life. And then there is life that the Bible calls eternal life, or the life that is life indeed, which consists in the full and permanent enjoyment of the presence and fellowship and favor of God. Now, this is what wisdom introduces you to. It gets you to where Adam and Eve might have gotten, they hadn't ascended, to the tree of life. Wisdom gives life to those that have it. Now, chapter 7, verse 14, days of prosperity, be joyful, and days of adversity, stop and think. What is God trying to say to you? If you've got trouble, stop and think. Does God have some reason for allowing this trouble in your life? It doesn't happen by chance. There is surely the permission of God behind it, and presumably some purpose intended for your improvement or for your good. And if you can get yourself into such a state of mind that you think, in the first place, whatever happens to me, I fall on the sidewalk and cut my face all up or something, this is not chance. God permitted this for a good purpose. This gives you some composure as you think about it. And secondly, you can recognize that God has purposes that are beyond simply the, let's say, comfort and pleasure of us humans. Now, Karl Barth, not my favorite patron saint after First St. Patrick, but Mr. Karl Barth, but he said some good things, though. And he's the one, you know, said it wasn't important whether the serpent spoke or what the serpent said. But I'll quote a better one here. Between man's purpose in time and God's purpose in eternity, there is an infinite qualitative difference. You see, we have our little purpose for today and tomorrow and our life and so forth. And, God has a long-range purpose that spans history and goes on into eternity. And these do not necessarily coincide. And what we think is the most desirable thing that has happened that we think may not be what God has planned. And God's plan is a long-range plan that includes all sorts of things besides just little me and my family and my friends and so forth. Now, there's this little song, God Bless America. Did we do that? Somebody said the Pilgrim Fathers landed at Plymouth Rock, and there on the rock was a sign that said, America, love it or leave it. Well, that's where that came from, Plymouth Rock. And I suppose there was one there also that said, McGovern and... what's the other guy's name? Oh, sure. Maybe Nixon and Agnew. I won't be part of politics here. Now, look, God bless America, land that I love, from the mountains to the prairies to the ocean white with foam. God bless America, my home, sweet home. It's sort of nice to finish on the 4th of July, you know. But look, why should God bless America? This is the country that's trying as hard as it can, head over heels, to get along without God. We put God on a reservation. He's drilled out of our schools and just about everything else. We've had whole Bible classes in some parts of the science hall because of this. Important principles of separation of church and state. At least we don't mention that. Now, if you were God, would you figure America rated his blessings? This country that is filled with crime and unbelief and modern, radical rejection of the authority of his word and all sorts of lawless disorder and people justifying this, you know. There's always been sins like adultery and fornication in the world and murder since Cain killed Abel and early people. But today, We have professors of theology and bishops and clergymen standing up and saying these things aren't wrong. And then we have the nerve to say, God bless America. Now, I hope God will bless America. I hope America can get to be the kind of a country that we could honestly and without hypocrisy ask God to bless. But I don't know. Mr. Fender, what do you think? Have we reached that yet? I'm afraid we're making progress backwards towards it. Well, now, we're told in further in chapter 7, 15 to 18, be not righteous over much, and be not over much wicked. Neither be thou foolish, why shouldest thou die before thy time? Be not righteous over much, why shouldest thou destroy thyself? It sounds like a contradiction. Don't be too righteous, and don't be too wicked. The golden mean. If I was standing up in chapel or college conversation and saying, now look, you can break the college rules, but do it moderately, in a temperate manner, and we expect students to act like Christian young people, but in moderation, of course, don't go to extremes for this kind of thing. That's what it sounds like as you read it there. Be not righteous over much, and be not wicked over much. Now, you cannot be too righteous in the real sense, the real righteousness. Any more than, well, suppose a medical doctor would tell you, now, now, just be careful. Don't try to be too healthy. Just a moderate degree of health. You don't want to be too healthy. And suppose a banker would tell you, you don't want to be too honest. Just a moderate amount of honesty. You see, these things are absolute, and anything less than the total is wrong. So when he speaks here about not being righteous over much, this must not refer to the real righteousness that is pleasing to God, but to the legalistic, technical, overstrained, sick-a-yearning, nitpicking righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. Now, I don't know, did I tell you in this class about the egg that was laid on the Sabbath? Huh? Mr. McMillan, Lord, Reverend William McMillan, in the chapel one day. See, this is in the Talmud of the Jewish faith. And you think these rabbis were off their rock. You think they're crazy. But they argued this seriously. May an egg laid on the Sabbath be eaten, or must it be, is it sinful, and must it be thrown away? Actually, the Talmud said a lot of stuff like that. They argued that seriously. And answered it in typically rabbinical and casuistical fashion. That all depends. Did you buy this hen to be a laying hen to keep her to lay eggs for you? If so, this egg is sinful and has to be thrown away. On the other hand, if you bought this hen predestinating her to be made into chicken and noodles before very long, in this case, the egg is incidental and may be used. Now, that kind of thing is the overstrained righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. Or as they found fault with Jesus and his disciples for getting a little ripe wheat in their hands as they went to the field on the Sabbath day and eating it like that. Harvesting a field on the Sabbath against the law. And Jesus defended the ripeness of his disciples. There was a woman in Scotland who was super, 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 duper, super strict about the Sabbath, and she objected to many things that fellow Christians thought was quite legitimate. And somebody said to her, didn't you ever read what Jesus and his disciples did as they went through the grain fields on the Sabbath day? She said, yes. I know that's in the Bible, but you know, I never did feel quite that it was right for him to do it. Now, that's being righteous over much. When you get a higher standard than the Lord has, that's what Kohelet is warning against. On the other hand, there's the opposite extreme, being wicked over much. This doesn't mean that it's all right to be a little bit wicked, but this is putting up the opposite extreme, which is antinomianism. Now, if you're a Greek student, you know what that word means. Antinomian is opposed to having any law. And he not only holds that you don't save yourself by obeying laws, but that you're not under any laws, in any sense, whatever. As a Christian, you can steal money or kill somebody. It just doesn't count because Christ already paid the penalty for it. That's antinomianism. Sect in Germany at the time of the Lutheran Reformation said good works are partially injurious to the spiritual life, and the spiritual Christian will be careful to avoid them. Martin Luther says The damnation is done. About those people. That's antinomianism, the opposite extreme. And people tend to flip-flop between one of these and the other, and both are wrong, you see. To be a technical righteousness monger like the Pharisees were, arguing about the world and so forth, is wrong, but also to flop to the other side where you claim that a Christian is under no standard of right living. We're saved, not saved by good works, but we're saved to live a good life. And what is a good life? A good life is what God says it is, and that's a form of law, a precept, you see. And I have known Christians in China with serious moral lapses, simply by quoting a text, "We're not under law, but under grace." It covers it. And that's the opposite extreme here that Sohelis is warning against. Now, it says here, the value of self-restraint of wisdom in the face of humiliation, the value of wisdom is better than what 10 mighty men or 10 rulers can give. Rulers to a competent and actually exercised rule. Wisdom will do you better than having 10 men on the city council that are important in all the prestigious court, if you have wisdom. And I think we'll go down a little further. Chapter 7, 21, 22. Wisdom gives a man proper self-control. Mahatma Gandhi of India was no Christian in the time of age. I worship an Hindu, but he lived on a pad, a real pad without any furniture. And above his pad, he had a plaque in English which said on it, "If you are right, you can afford to keep your temper. If you are wrong, you cannot afford to lose it." I've often thought of that, attending church sinners. If you are right, you can afford to keep your temper. And if you are wrong, you cannot afford to lose it. That would be a good rule, even though Gandhi wasn't a Christian. Now, 7:21, it speaks of masters and servants. And this raises the question, who are these anyhow? And according to Leopold, and I will test my vote with him, Israel is the master, rightly considered. Israel, when faithful to God, would have been on top and not underneath other people. Israel is supposed to be the master, and the Gentiles ought to be Israel's servants, even though in point of fact, in Kohelet's say everything is upside down and topsy-turvy, but Israel is regarded as the master. Now, by bearing with equanimity all that their oppressors might say in scorn, or with the express intent of galling Israel, the Israelites would make the best use of the strength that wisdom can afford. In other words, control yourself and don't blow your top over provocation. If you can learn to control your utterance and your temper, you will win out in the end. I saw a cartoon of a man sprawled out in a Morris chair with a 40-inch section of paper, and his wife was standing in front of him in this posture, evidently turning out for something. He's just sitting there, not saying anything, and she says, "Say something! Don't just sit there agreeing with everything I say." Now, I'm sure that none of you young ladies would ever be a persecuting wife like that, just your husband that way. But silence is often the best answer to something. It takes the wind out of the fellow's sail. You can just keep your cool and remain silent. This is much more effective than getting into an angry, wrangling dialogue or debate with somebody many times. Try it out and you'll see. It isn't easy to do, though. Now, Luke Paul says that Israel as a nation has heard their servants curse them, that they have been, 722 here, Israel as a nation have cursed others. That Israel is a nation that had a wrong attitude toward other people. The Jews called the Samaritans dogs. They spoke with uninhibited contempt of other people, whereas their real mission was to represent God to these people and try to be a witness for the true God to them. But instead of this, they looked down on them with a haughty superiority, and this was, of course, very wrong. Now, 7:23, it says, "Wisdom was far from me."
He doesn't claim himself to have found the utter and true wisdom. And it says that it is far off. A little further here, I applied my heart to know and search and seek out wisdom and the reason of things and to follow the wickedness, know the wickedness of folly and the foolishness and madness. And I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets and her hands as bands. Whoso pleaseth God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be taken by her. The common and traditional interpretation of that is that it's a warning to watch out and not associate with women of loose morals. Leopold says this, while it's just taken by itself, it would seem to say that. This cannot be the meaning because it would be totally foreign to the context here and could not be fitted into the buildup that he's having here. So what does he say this woman who is more bitter than death really stands for? Mr. Middling? Heathen or pagan secular philosophy which tangles a person up. Now, I studied philosophy 1 year at Princeton University and survived, but they had a man there, head of the philosophy department, named Spike, F-I-T-E. He was an atheist. And let me tell you, many a student who came there with only an old traditional Christian background and not a vital experience lost his religion in Spike's classes and became an unbeliever. Many a one. And Spike was sarcastic and nasty in his remarks about Christians. When Mr. Ventil's grandfather was getting his Ph.D., he got a thesis on Hume under Dr. Fife, this atheist. And Fife, did you ever hear this here in this story? All right, I'll tell you. Fife, Mr. Ventil, I hear you're a Calvinist. Yes. Do you believe in predestination? Yes. Do you believe in double predestination? Yes. Well, what do you know about that? That was Fife. But he got his Ph.D. with distinction and honor under this man. But Spike ruined the faith of many a student. And heathen philosophy is a dangerous thing to go playing around with unless you really know your onions to start with and have a good foundation. And this is very disturbing and unsettling. And so it is said to be here more bitter than death. Leaves God out, you see, and explains the universe without God. And the one who pleases God will escape it. And who is taken by this woman is the one who is the sinner. Now, we come a little further here. And you see, it was a danger that Israel would copy the philosophy of the nation that had conquered them and was ruling them. And this they had to be warned against. People often imitate what is the going thing and promoted by the government and so forth. Now, brainwashed by the times. As to the number of people who have found the true wisdom, now, all the young ladies in the class, please note, I didn't write these next three verses. They're in the Bible. I didn't put them there. And I don't think they mean what some people have thought. One man among a thousand I have found, but a woman among all those have I not found. Now, please note, in the first place, Kohelet doesn't place himself as the one man among the thousand. He doesn't claim himself to have found the absolute wisdom, as we saw a few verses up the column. Leopold says maybe he has in mind a few people like Moses and Isaiah and Jeremiah who were outstanding in their relationship to God and says one among a thousand. Now, furthermore, with regard to women, women in many ways excel men. And what would the world be without? But when it comes to constructive systems where logical thinking is the primary thing, history shows that women have not produced the constructive systems of philosophy and theology. On the other hand, there have been many that have been poets, musicians, authors, artists, and have distinguished themselves very much in these lines. So this is simply recognizing the created and God-established psychological difference between the sexes. Women tend to go more by emotion and men by logical thinking sometimes. C.S. Lewis, in one of his books, Christian Behavior, I believe, has an illustration of this. Your dog has put in the neighbor's baby, and you've got to go over there next door and apologize for this and offer to pay the emergency room at the hospital bill for this affair. Who do you want to talk to, the baby's father or the baby's mother? Oh, you want to talk to the baby's father. Well, now what? You're afraid of the baby's mother. You're afraid she'll practically bite your nose off when you come over there to talk about your dog biting her baby. But don't blame the baby's mother for this. God has made women this way. They are fiercely defensive of their offspring. This is one way God gets little children taken care of in a dangerous world. But don't expect the baby's mother, who's been bitten by your dog, to take a calm, philosophical view of this. Because she won't. But you go over there and talk to the baby's father, and he says, "Sure, George, here, sit down, have a cigar." And you talk it over, and you say, "I'm sorry, we're going to keep the dog tied up, and just let me have the bill, and we'll see if it says, why, certainly, George, no problem. Everything is settled." Now, Lewis, the point of this is, who should be the head of the family, the husband or the wife? And he says there are some things that have to be decided by, let's say, logic rather than sentiment. And there are other things where life would be pretty bleak if we didn't have the sentiment and the affection and the love that women excel in. So he is only, Kohelis is not downgrading women here. He's stating what he has found, and please note, he doesn't even include himself, but the one in a thousand that he has found. So maybe we have cleared this from the strictures of the women's lib movement. I don't think they know it's in there anyhow. Maybe they'll find it out someday. Now, chapters 8, 9, and 10. Problems on which wisdom throws light. And first of all, in chapter 8, submission to the heavenly king. Chapter 8, verses 1 to 8. This, of course, you realize, is in the positive section of the book telling how godly people ought to live in the face of hard times and bad times. Chapter 8, verse 2, "I counsel thee to keep the king's commandments, and that in regard of the oath of God." Now, that involves two problems. In the first place, who is this king? And in the second place, what is this oath that is mentioned here? Who is this king? And there are two possibilities here. This may be a human king, and then it would be a counsel to, let's say, practice law and order. Don't break the law. Observe the king's commandments. So on the turnpike, 65 miles an hour is the limit on this end of it. And that this would be equivalent to saying, "I counsel thee to be a law-abiding citizen under whatever government you happen to live." But loopholes suggest that this is probably not the meaning of this, that this king here presumably means God, and that this implies that we should keep the commandment of God here. I'll read my note here. Question 518, on what ground? There must be an organic connection of verse 2 with verse 1. To interpret 2a of obedience to civil rulers would be out of context. Moreover, the teaching would then be tritely obvious. Israel was not inclined to rebellion and did not need such a counsel as to obey rulers. Revolt against the Persians would have been not merely hopeless, but insane. Now, the Jews did sometimes rebel against great empires, twice against the Romans, for example. They also tried to play the great empires off against each other, Egypt against Assyria, Assyria against Babylon, and sometimes this didn't work, sometimes it did. But once they had been conquered by one of these powers, they settled down for a long, long period, and they were quite law-abiding and quiet and peaceful under the empire that governed them, whichever one it might be. And as Luke Paul says, to disobey the laws of the ancient Persians for an Israelite, a member of this despised and poor and defenseless subject people, would have been virtually impossible. It would have been insane folly to try to do this. Therefore, he holds that this ruler here is God and not simply a human king. Now, the next thing is the oath that is mentioned. I want to keep the king's commandments, but that in regard of the oath of God. And is this oath of God, then, an oath taken in the name of God to obey rulers, or is it, a covenant or an oath taken to God about allegiance to God? Does this pledge allegiance to a civil ruler, or does it pledge allegiance to God? And the loophole holds that this is a covenant, that it's a pledge of allegiance to God or loyalty to God, and he counsels people, having taken this kind of a pledge, to keep them. Keep God's commandments and your covenant vows to God. Now that is question 520, and we are still have a few minutes left here. Maybe we can go back and see something. 517, what does true wisdom do for a person's faith and why? The verse is chapter 8, verse 1, the second part. A man's wisdom maketh his face to shine, and the boldness, the loophole says, the hardness or harshness of his face shall be changed. Have you ever noticed anybody that has become a Christian with a very definite Christian experience that changes their face some? Ever noticed anything like that? Well, I saw a student on campus the other day that I knew had not been a Christian a year ago, and I said, "You look very happy." She said, "I am. You know Jesus Christ." You could see the difference. Now, Cardinal Mercier, Roman Catholic cardinal in the died a generation ago in Belgium, I believe, but he was quite a fellow, comparable to Bishop Sheen in this country. And Mercier said, after the age of 40, a man is responsible for his faith, or a woman. A person is responsible for their faith after the age of 40. From 0 to 40, you take what nature gave you. But after 40, the kind of person you are and the kind of thinking you have done has etched itself in your faith. And you can try to hide it, but your face tells everybody, wherever you go, something about your personality. After the age of 40, the person is responsible for his face. Could you change it very much after that? Well, you could try, and maybe God can work wonders, but I don't think it's likely that a person could. You know what? President Woodrow Wilson made a limerick about faces. For beauty, he wasn't just exactly a movie star. For beauty, I am not a star. There are others more handsome by far. But my face, I don't mind it, for I am behind it. It's the folks out in front that I adore. Now, Kohelet says here that if you really have wisdom, a real thing, it makes your face to shine and takes away the hardness. This would be the harsh and hard lines that are the telltale effects of sin. And of course, in youth, we don't see these so much. In older people, they have become more established. And some people, you can tell just by looking at them, there's an unhappy person with a bitter attitude toward life. And others, just by looking at them, they're happy. Now, I think maybe I mentioned one day the kids had a game to see who could offer the prize, who could make the ugliest face. And Aunt Susie won, and she wasn't even playing. That's a nice way of subtle hint to Aunt Susie. She wasn't even playing. But it is true that the radiant joy that is within, if you know Jesus Christ in a vital and personal way, is going to show in your face. And if you are more or less going to the devil, that's going to show in your face too. You can't conceal it. It's bound to. Your face reflects your real inner personality. And of course, you can use cosmetics and go to the beauty parlor and get this and that done to it. But I think in the end, your face is going to tell the truth about you, especially if you're over 40, which of course nobody in this class
could possibly be.
I'm only 39 and three quarters. Times two. All right, now, who has another question? We've got 7 minutes that you'd like to have discussed. Yeah, Mr. Byron 15. How does the Jewish Targum interpret the King of 8:2? Now, the Targum is a Jewish commentary on the Old Testament. These are what we would call commentaries. They're used in parallel to it and with comments or interpretations. The Jewish Targum interprets this King as meaning God. And it adds this comment, in the time of the anger of the Lord, do not cease to pray before him, tremble before him, and so on. So there's at least traditional authority, in addition to Dr. Lupo himself, for holding that this King here is God and not a mere human ruler. Now, that was 520. Go one beyond, 521, chapter 8, verse 3. Be not hasty to go out of his sight. Stand not in an evil thing, for he doeth whatsoever pleaseth him. This is traditionally interpreted of, you get an interview with an earthly king, don't stomp out of the room. We had a man on the faculty, he is long gone from here, but he taught in one of our departments, and he got mad in the faculty meeting and got up and stomped out to, like a little kid having a tantrum, and slammed the door. And Dr. Clark, who was the guidance, was in room 20 at the other end of the hall here. He said, what's going on here anyway? And this guy had stomped out of the room and didn't just shut the door, he slammed it real hard. He was mad. Now that lowered his stature among the whole faculty. At least couldn't hear a thing discussed or decided by a majority vote without getting mad like that. Threw off that way. And this is traditionally interpreted, this the third verse here, to don't stomp out of the king's presence and lose your temper, because it won't be any good. The king does whatever pleases him. Now, Luke holds this is quite impossible as an interpretation of this. Let me ask, how many of you ever had a 15-minute personal interview with President Nixon? How many of you been to the White House? Well, you can go on a tour of the show parts of the White House. I saw a man taking a chihuahua door. He had a new coat, the nose sticking out. Took him to the White House. But they don't take you in where the president is working and where Mrs. Nixon has her bedroom and so forth. You see the parts that are intended to be shown to tourists. Do you suppose Congressman Clark could get you an appointment for a 15-minute interview with the president? Now, Clark's a Democrat, but waving that little point, it doesn't make any difference anymore. Do you suppose he could get you an appointment for a personal interview with the president of the United States? Very doubtful. Dr. Stuart Lee of our faculty has met President Nixon and was there at a conference on consumer affairs and his pictures in the paper standing alongside of Nixon. But as far as I know, he's the only one of the near the college family that has had this distinction. And for a Jew, an Israelite, in Kohelet's period, away out on the fringe in this, let's say, despised little country of Palestine, to hope to have a personal interview with a Persian king in Susa or Persepolis, this would be beyond their wildest dreams. Virtually impossible. Of course, you can't say absolutely impossible, but there were people like Daniel and Nehemiah and so on, but virtually impossible. And that therefore this is not an exhortation to avoid losing your temper and stomping out of the audience chamber of the king. Rather, it refers to God and can be paraphrased something like this. Do not be hasty to cast off your allegiance when the Omnipotent One does not grant you instantaneous relief. In other words, when you pray and don't get what you want, at least not straight away, don't lose your religion over this, but keep it and keep on praying. Now, I saw in a little kid's catechism that does God answer the prayers of Christian believers? And it said yes. The person wrote this catechism had no pedagogical insight at all. It didn't have questions that can be answered by yes or no, but said yes. Next question. How does God answer our prayers? It said three ways. Yes, no, or wait. And I think this is true. God
teaches us the virtue of patience by not always, of course sometimes he does, but not always giving us what we want or ask for as we ask for it or when we ask for it. And this is part of religion. Remember, we are only humans and God is God. And therefore, not be hasty to cast your allegiance to God off because things aren't going the way you would choose. Now, Luke also adds that this qualifying clause here, he doeth whatsoever pleaseth him, cannot apply even to a Persian king.